seemed insurmountable. Northerners boasted a population of more than 20 million, while the white population of the South, that is, those who were eligible to bear arms, numbered under 6 million. Slaves were used in labor situations to supplement the Confederate Army in building bridges, digging trenches, and driving wagons, but the slaves often constituted, at best, a potentially hostile force that had to be guarded, further diminishing active frontline troops. In all, the Union put 2.1 million men into the field, 46,000 draftees, 118,000 paid substitutes, and the rest volunteers in the regular army or militia. Rebel forces totaled 800,000, of which almost one-fourth were either draftees or substitutes. It is an irony, then, that today's neo-Confederates and libertarians who berate the Union as oppressing the rights of free men ignore the fact that the Confederacy forced more free whites under arms than the North. Union forces deserted in higher absolute numbers, 200,000 to just more than half that number of Confederates, but as a proportion of the total wartime force, the rebels saw almost 12.5% of their army desert, compared to less than 10% of the Union forces. Nevertheless, it would not take long before the Yankees realized the mettle of their opponent. The valor and tenacity of the rebels, winning battle after battle with smaller forces and holding off the North for 4 years, is a testament to both their commitment to the Confederate cause, as they saw it, and, more important, to their nurturing as Americans, themselves steeped in the Western way of war. If only in the war's duration, the elan and skill of the Confederate soldiers is noteworthy. The commercial differences between the Union and Confederacy were even more striking. Much has been made of the railroad mileage, although depending on how one measured the tracks laid in the territories and the border states, some of the northern advantage disappears. The North had as many as 12,000 miles of track, whereas the South had perhaps 10,000. But even if these numbers had been roughly equal, they would have been misleading. Southern roads tended to run east and west, which was an advantage as long as the Mississippi remained open and Texas's cattle and horses could be brought in through Louisiana. But after New Orleans fell and Vicksburg was all but surrounded, all livestock the Western Confederacy could supply were undeliverable. More important, northern railroads often ran north-south, making for rapid delivery to the front lines of cannonballs, food, and clothing. Some southern states actually built tracks that only connected to rivers, with no connection to other railroads, and Alabama had laid a shortcut railroad that connected two Tennessee river points. Dominance by the North over the South in other areas was even more pronounced. 32-1 in firearms production, 14-1 in merchant shipping, 3-1 in farm acreage, 412-1 in wheat, and 2-1 in corn. Cotton might have been king, but Southerners soon found that their monarch did not make for good eating. And the North controlled 94% of manufactured cotton cloth and 90% of America's boot and shoe manufacturing. Pig iron manufacturing was almost entirely northern, with all but a few of the nation's 286 furnaces residing in the Union. Those facilities churned out iron for 239 arms manufacturers, again overwhelmingly located north of the Mason-Dixon line. One county in Connecticut, which was home to 9 firearms factories, manufactured guns worth 10 times the value of all firearms in the entire South in 1860. The South had one cannon foundry at the Tredegar Iron Works in Richmond. From Cyrus McCormick's Reaper factory in Chicago to the Paterson, New Jersey locomotive works, northern manufacturing was poised to bury the South. In its navy alone, the North had an almost insurmountable advantage, and Lincoln perceived this, announcing an immediate blockade of the South by sea. The blockade underscored Lincoln's definition of the war as an insurrection and rebellion. Had the South had a navy, its seagoing commerce with England and France might have been substantial enough to legitimate its claims of being a nation. Winners set the rules, and the winner at sea was the Union Navy. And again, a manufacturing economy tends to produce manifold inventions. The Union's willingness to set the private sector free to invent, then purchase the products afterward, led to a number of private sector weapons, including the Gatling gun and the Spencer repeating rifle. Even in the South, the breakthroughs came from private individuals, as with Horace Lawson Huntley and his submarine. In a contest between a state-dominated economy, as the Confederacy was, and an economy largely reliant on the private sector, the North held another major edge. Yet even with these advantages, the Union still faced a daunting task. All the South had to do to succeed was to survive. The Confederates did not have to invade the North, and every year that passed brought the reality of an independent Confederate nation ever closer. The American Revolution had taught that all an army of resistance need do is avoid destruction. And more in 1861 than 1776, the technology favored the defender. Combinations of earthworks with repeating or breech-loading rifles, long-range cannons, and mass transportation with railroads and steam vessels meant that defenders could resist many times their number and receive timely reinforcements or perform critical withdrawals. Moreover, the United States had only a small professional army by European standards, and after 1861, that army was reduced by about half, as Southerners resigned to fight for the CSA. As a result, both sides relied heavily on militia troops. Militia units, as was learned in the Revolution and the War of 1812, had important strengths and failings. Village militia units, comprised of all men of the ages 15 through 50, mustered once a year, trained and drilled irregularly, and provided their own weapons. But militias lacked the critical discipline, professionalism, and experience that regular soldiers possessed, leading Samuel Clemens to refer to his militia company as a cattle herd, in which an argument broke out between a corporal and sergeant, neither of whom knew who outranked the other. To overcome these weaknesses, state militias were retained intact as units, ensuring that Ohioans, Mainers, and New Yorkers fought together. This enhanced unit cohesion and loyalty, but also produced tragic results when the order of battle hurled the manhood of entire towns into enemy guns. As a result, some towns saw an entire generation disappear in 4 years of war. The militia regular army volunteer units became largely a personal thing, in which anyone who wished could advertise to raise a company and invite all willing to join to come on a certain morning to some saloon, hotel, or public hall. Units that emerged predictably had flashy names and even glitzier uniforms, including the Buena Vista Guards, the New York Fire Zouaves, the Polish Legion, the St. Patrick's Brigade, the Garibaldi Guards, and, again predictably, the Lincoln Guards. Some, such as the Wisconsin Black Hats, also known as the Iron Brigade, were famous for their headgear, while New York Zouave units copied the French Army's baggy red trousers. Some of the extremely decorative uniforms soon gave way to more practical battlefield gear, but the enthusiasm did not dim. The 6th Massachusetts, a regiment of 850 men, marched to Washington only 48 hours after Lincoln's call for volunteers, and between the time the president issued the call for 75,000 volunteers in April and the time Congress convened in July, the Northern Army had swollen by more than 215,000 over its pre-Sumter troop levels. Illinois and Indiana in particular outdid themselves, with Illinois furnishing 172% of its quota and Indiana 158%. Instead of too few men, the Union's greatest problem at the outset of the conflict was too many. Secretary of War Cameron complained he was receiving troops faster than the government can provide for them. When the first weary soldiers marched into Washington to defend the Capitol, all that awaited them was salted red herring, soda crackers, and coffee made in rusty cauldrons. Those who marched to the front were more fortunate than others crammed into coastal vessels and steamed down from New England port cities. Regardless of their mode of transportation, most of the young men who donned the uniform of either the North or South had never been more than 20 miles from home, nor had they ever ridden a steamboat. Many had never seen a large city. Command in the Union Army was ravaged by the departure of a large number of the U.S. Army's officer corps, both active and retired, who left for the Confederate cause. Indeed, from 1776 to 1861, and even to the present, Southerners filled the ranks of America's professional fighting forces in disproportionate numbers in relation to their population. Southern soldiers outnumbered Northerners significantly in the Mexican-American War, and West Point graduated a higher rate of Southern second lieutenants than Northern. Southern officers, such as Thomas J. Stonewall Jackson, Braxton Bragg, Albert Sidney Johnston, Joseph E. Johnston, and Robert E. Lee, reneged on their oath to protect the United States from enemies, foreign and domestic, to fight in gray. In all, 313 U.S. Army officers resigned to join the Confederacy, whereas 767 regular Army officers stayed to form the new Union cadre. Lee was especially reluctant, having been offered the position of Commander-in-Chief of the Union Army by Lincoln. Yet he could not persuade himself to raise his hand against Virginia, and reluctantly joined the Confederates. A more touching departure occurred with the resignation of Joseph E. Johnston of Virginia, who met Secretary of War Cameron in April 1861. He wept as he said, "I must go. Though I am resigning my position, I trust I may never draw my sword against the old flag." More than manpower and brains left the Union cause. Confederates stormed armories and arsenals. They captured the valuable Norfolk docks and shipyards, taking 9 warships into custody at the Gosport Navy Yard. Although the New York and Pennsylvania went up in flames, the Confederates salvaged a third vessel, the Merrimack. Had the Union commander of the Navy Yard given the order, the steam-powered Merrimack could have escaped entirely, but he buckled to the pressure of the rebels, providing the hull for what would become one of the world's first ironclads. In the larger context, however, these losses were minimal and paled beside the substantial advantages that the North possessed. For example, supplementing the militias and regular army enlistments, in 1862, the Union allowed free blacks to join segregated infantry units. Thousands enlisted, at first receiving only $7 per month as compared to $13 allowed for a white private. 2 years later, with Lincoln's support, Congress passed the Enrollment Act, authorizing equal pay for black soldiers. Even for white regulars, however, a military career was not exactly lucrative. Prior to the war, a general made less than $3,500 a year, compared to a senator's $5,000, whereas a captain received $768 annually. Only the engineering corps seemed exempt from the low pay, attracting many of the best officers, including Robert E. Lee, who directed port improvements along the Mississippi River. Like the North, the South hoped to avoid a draft, but reality set in. The Confederate Congress enacted a Conscription Act in 1862, even before the Union, establishing the first military draft in American history. All able-bodied males 18 to 35 had to serve for 3 years, although wartime demands soon expanded the ages from 17 to 50. Exemptions were granted postal employees, CSA officials, railroad workers, religious ministry, and those employed in manufacturing plants. Draftees could also hire substitutes, of which there were 70,000 in the South, compared with 118,000 in the North. Given the higher rates of Northern regular enlistments, however, it is apparent that Southerners purchased their way out of combat or avoided going to war at a higher overall rate than their counterparts in blue. Conscription to many Southerners violated the principles they seemed to be fighting for, leading to criticisms that the Confederate draft itself constituted an act of despotism. Attack and die? There were powerful cultural forces at work that shaped each side's views of everything from what to eat to how to fight. Historians Grady McWhitney and Perry Jameson have proposed the famous Celtic thesis to explain Confederate tactics. Northerners tended to be more Anglo-Saxon and Teutonic, Southerners more Celtic. This had tremendous implications for the way in which each side fought, with the South consumed by self-assertion and manly pride. In their controversial book, Attack and Die, McWhitney and Jameson claimed that the Celtic herding and agrarian culture that dominated the South propagated a military culture based on attack and, especially, full frontal charges. Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, urged his troops to go on the offensive and to plant our banners on the banks of the Ohio. Historian Bernard DeVoto quipped that Davis had just enough success in war in Mexico to ensure the South's defeat. Union Colonel Benjamin Buell observed, "An insane desire on the part of the Southern people and some of the generals to assume the offensive." The Confederate Celtic code of officer loyalty demanded they lead their men into battle. Such tactics devastated the Confederate command structure. 55% of the South's generals were killed or wounded in battle, and many had already been shot or wounded before they received their mortal wound. More telling, Confederate casualty rates, men wounded and killed to the number of soldiers in action, were consistently higher than the Union's in almost every major battle, regardless of the size of forces engaged, generals in command, or outcome of the engagement. Only at Fredericksburg, with Burnside's suicidal charges against Marye's Heights, did Union casualty rates exceed those of the supposedly better-led rebels. Lee, for all his purported military genius, suffered 20% in casualties while inflicting only 15% on his enemy, whereas Grant suffered 18% in casualties but inflicted 30% on his foes. Overall, Lee only inflicted 13,000 more casualties on the Federals than he absorbed, a ratio completely incompatible with a smaller population seeking to defeat a larger one. Grant, on the other hand, inflicted 12% more casualties on enemy commanders he encountered. Victories won through offensive action by the South were decidedly Pyrrhic, and losses involving Southern offensives, especially Gettysburg, where Lee lost more than 30% of his entire command, were disastrous. Some of the propensity for taking the offensive must be blamed on the necessity for Confederate diplomatic breakthroughs. Until Gettysburg, the Confederacy pinned its dim hopes on Britain's or France's entering the fight on its side. But Europeans were unsure whether the Confederacy's defensive strategy was of its own choosing or was forced on it by Northern might. Thus, taking the war to the North figured prominently in the efforts to convince Britain and France that the CSA was legitimate. Yet this strategy proved to be flawed. The North seriously misjudged the commitment and skill of its foe, but at least from the outset appreciated the nature of its initial military objectives and its economic advantages. Nevertheless, neither Lincoln nor his generals fully understood how difficult the task would be in 1861. Ultimately, however, the difference between North and South came down to Lincoln's being a great war president, whereas Jefferson Davis was a mediocre one. Where Davis had graduated from West Point and fought in the Mexican War, Lincoln did not know how to write a military order, but he learned. By the power of his mind, he became a fine strategist, according to T. Harry Williams, and was a better natural strategist than were most of the trained soldiers. He immediately perceived that the Union had to use its manpower and economic advantage, and it had to take the offensive. Still, Lincoln had much to absorb, some of it from Union General-in-Chief Winfield Scott, old Fuss and Feathers of Mexican War fame, by then 74 years old and notorious for falling asleep at councils of war, engineered the initial strategy for the Union Army, the Anaconda Plan. Designed to take advantage of the Union's naval power, Scott envisioned U.S. naval vessels blockading the ports on the Atlantic and Gulf coasts and the lower Mississippi River. Gradually using gunboats and ground forces, the North would sever the Western Confederacy from the Eastern Confederacy by controlling the Mississippi. This would have the twofold effect of starving the Confederates and denying them additional men and horses on the one hand, and preventing aid from overseas from reaching the rebels on the other. Lincoln's advisors initially put far too much faith in the Anaconda Plan, hoping that it could strangle the enemy without the need for crushing all rebel resistance. But the strategy of blockades and dividing the Confederacy in two along the Mississippi would prove vital when later combined with other strategic aims. The blockade did have an effect. As early as July 1861, Jefferson Davis told James Chesnut in Richmond, "We begin to cry out for more ammunition, and already the blockade is beginning to shut it all out." By April 1865, the Confederacy had used up its copper supply and could make no more percussion caps, leaving it entirely dependent on the unreliable blockade runners, whose numbers diminished by the day. Once again, though, the Confederacy played to the Union's strength, this time through its short-sighted diplomatic decision to embargo the sale of cotton to Europe. Rebel leaders mistakenly believed that a cotton-starved Britain or France might enter the war in a few months, echoing the old "cotton is king" mantra of the 1850s. In reality, the cotton embargo proved disastrous. The British easily shifted to new sources of cotton, especially India and Egypt, so as a consequence, the strategy simultaneously deprived the Confederacy of income from the only significant product that could have brought in funds, while coalescing the planter elites around protecting their cotton investment. Planters kept their slave workforces growing cotton, when they could have been repairing railroads, building forts, or otherwise doing tasks that kept white soldiers from combat. Both the Anaconda Plan and cotton diplomacy clouded the real military picture. In 1861, few thinkers in either army clearly saw that only a comprehensive two-front war in the West and Virginia would produce victory. Neither side ever approached the total war level of mobilization and destruction later seen in World War I, but the North gradually adopted what historian James McPherson called hard war. Hard war meant two, and later more, simultaneous fronts and the destruction of cities without, if possible, the slaughter of the inhabitants. It meant constant assault. It meant mobilizing public opinion. Most of all, it meant attacking the economic and commercial pillar of slavery that propped up the Confederacy. Lincoln only came to this understanding after a year of bloody battlefield setbacks. At the outset, Lincoln had no intention of making emancipation the war aim, nor is it likely he could have persuaded his troops to fight to free blacks. Northerners went to war because the South had broken the law in the most fundamental way. After teaching Johnny Reb a lesson, the war would be over. When it dragged on, a combination of other motivations set in, including retribution, a perceived threat to the Constitution, and later, emancipation. Southern soldiers, on the other hand, fought because they saw federal troops invading their home states. "Why are you fighting in this war?" Union troops asked a captured soldier. "Because you're down here," he replied. While the war may have been about slavery, soldiers fought for a variety of motivations. Bull Run and Union Failure. "Forward to Richmond," blared a front-page headline from the New York Tribune in June 1861. Already impatient with the Anaconda Plan, Northern voices called for a speedy victory to capture the new Confederate capital of Richmond and end the conflict. Lincoln unwisely agreed to an immediate assault, realizing that every day the Confederacy remained independent, it gained in legitimacy. He told the commanding general, Irwin McDowell, who headed the Army of the Potomac, "You are green, it's true, but they are green also. You are all green alike." McDowell developed a sound plan, marching 36,000 men out of Washington and into Northern Virginia on July 16, 1861. There, Confederate General Pierre Beauregard, fresh from his triumph at Fort Sumter, met him with a smaller force of 20,000 near a railroad crossing at Manassas on the south bank of the river called Bull Run. Another rebel force of 12,000 under Joe Johnston operated in the Shenandoah Valley. The aged Union General Robert Patterson was instructed to keep Johnston from reinforcing Beauregard. Benefiting from the scouting of J.E.B. Jeb Stuart's cavalry and from reliable spy reports, Johnston slipped away from Patterson and headed for Manassas. Thus, McDowell would find not one, but two rebel armies when he finally arrived at Bull Run on Sunday, July 21st. Expecting an entertaining victory, hundreds of Washington civilians, including congressmen and tourists, arrived at the battlefield with picnic baskets in horse-drawn carriages. What they saw instead was one of the worst routs of the Civil War. General Johnston arrived and, aided by General Thomas Stonewall Jackson, drove the Yankees from the field. Federal forces fell back across the river, where they encountered the gawking civilians now scrambling to pick up their lunches and climb into their carriages ahead of the retreating army. One congressman who had come out as a spectator reported, "There was never anything like it. For causeless, sheer, absolute, absurd cowardice, or rather panic, on this miserable earth. Off they went, one and all, off down the highway, over across fields, towards the woods, anywhere they could escape. To enable them better to run, they threw away their blankets, knapsacks, canteens, and finally muskets, cartridge boxes, and everything else." An orderly retreat soon turned into a foot race back to Washington. A reporter for the London Times, W.H. Russell, who accompanied the reserves, had just started forward when terrified soldiers shot past him in the opposite direction. "What does this mean?" he asked a fleeing officer, who replied, "Why, it means that we are pretty badly whipped." The road back to the Capitol was strewn with muskets, backpacks, caps, and blankets as men, tripping and stumbling, grabbing wagons or caissons, dashed for safety. In the first of many missed opportunities on both sides, however, Johnston failed to pursue the Union Army into Washington and possibly end the war. While the South had a stunning victory, it also had 600 deaths, matched by the federal casualties, making it the most costly battle fought on American soil since 1815. Within months, each army would long for the day when it marked its casualty figures in the hundreds instead of the thousands. Despite the North's shocking defeat, Bull Run proved indecisive, producing no serious military disadvantage for the North, nor gain except in terms of pride for the South. The South did find a new hero, Stonewall Jackson, whose nickname derived from the moment in the battle when a South Carolina general pointed to him, saying, "There is Jackson standing like a stone wall." Aside from that, the rebel army was a mess. Johnston lamented it was more disorganized by victory than that of the United States by defeat. The South learned few lessons from the clash, but did comprehend the tremendous advantage railroads provided. Had the Confederacy carefully assessed the situation, it would have avoided any battlefield situation that did not provide close interior lines of support. The South also decided it had to change uniforms. The U.S. Army wore blue, as did many Southern units that had just recently resigned from the Union, leading entire units to come under friendly fire at Bull Run. The Confederates soon adopted the gray uniforms of the Virginia Military Institute. Meanwhile, as Lincoln and his advisors soberly assessed the situation, the setback actually stimulated their war preparations. Some Lincoln critics assail him for not calling up a larger army sooner, whereas others castigate him for being overly aggressive. In fact, prior to the first musket balls flying, Lincoln hoped to demonstrate his goodwill to the South by not mobilizing for an invasion. Bull Run obviously dashed such hopes, and Lincoln reconsidered the military situation. The Union quickly fortified Washington, D.C. with a string of defenses. Troops, troops, tents, the frequent thunder of guns practicing, lines of heavy baggage wagons, all indications of an immense army, noted one observer. Another, using his spyglass to take detailed notes, recorded 34 regiments, more than 80,000 men, encamped, and on another day saw 150 army wagons on Pennsylvania Avenue alone. A massive manpower buildup was only one sign, though, of the Union's resolve. In July 1861, Congress passed the Crittenden-Johnson resolutions, declaring support for a war to defend and maintain the supremacy of the Constitution and to preserve the Union with all the dignity, equality, and rights of the several states unimpaired. Sponsored by Crittenden and Tennessee Democrat Andrew Johnson, the resolutions provided a broad-based warning from Northerners and border state politicians of both parties that, if not addressed and punished, secession would lead to a collapse of law and order everywhere. Between the lines, the resolutions warned Lincoln that the war could not appear to be a campaign against slavery itself. Theoretically, this put Lincoln in a bind, though one of his own making. He had held at the outset that the Confederacy represented a rebellion by a handful of individuals, and that the Southern states had never legally left the Union. That meant these states could be restored with constitutional protections intact, including slavery, if or when the Southern states returned. Congress, however, had already provided Lincoln a means of leveraging the war toward abolition at some future point. In May 1861, Union General Benjamin Beast Butler, having conquered Fortress Monroe, Virginia, announced his intention to retain slaves as contrabands of war, including any fugitive slaves who escaped behind his lines. 3 months later, the Congress, with the Democrats in almost unanimous opposition, passed the First Confiscation Act, which provided for the seizure of property the rebels used to support their resistance, including all slaves who fought with the Confederate Army or who worked directly for it. Confiscation hurt Lincoln's efforts to keep Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri in the Union. Not long after Congress acted, General John Fremont in Missouri issued orders to confiscate any rebel slaves there, implying that the act amounted to a declaration of emancipation. Fremont's impetuous interpretation prompted a quick response from the president, who instructed Fremont to bring his orders in line with the letter of the Confiscation Act. This edict probably kept Kentucky in the Union. Lincoln had responded to the Bull Run debacle by shaking up the command structure, replacing McDowell with General George B. McClellan, who then was elevated to the position of General-in-Chief of the Army after Scott's retirement in November 1861. McClellan, who likened himself to Napoleon, was an organizational genius whose training of the Union Army no doubt played a critical role in preparing it for the long war. Intelligent and energetic, occasionally arrogant, McClellan did indeed share some traits with Napoleon. but he completely lacked Napoleon's acute sense of timing, where the enemy's weaknesses were, where to strike, and when. Not wishing to risk his popularity with the men, McClellan was reluctant to sacrifice them when the need arose. Worse, he viewed his own abilities as far superior to those of Lincoln, a man he viewed as possessing inferior antecedents and abilities. A Douglas Democrat, politics were never far from George McClellan's mind, although, ironically, no general did more to educate Lincoln in the academic elements of strategy and tactics. Lincoln's wisdom in perceiving the overarching picture in 1862 and 1863 owed much to the Union's Napoleon. McClellan's weaknesses were not apparent in mid-1861, when, even before his first big battle, he was touted as a future president. But he lacked aggressiveness, a trait fostered by his perfectionist nature. The general constantly complained that he lacked adequate troops, often asserting that he needed an unreasonable 10-to-1 advantage before he could attack, supplies, and artillery, where, in contrast, Napoleon had fought while outnumbered on numerous occasions, using the overconfidence of the enemy to defeat him. Secretary of War Edwin Stanton disparagingly said of McClellan, "We have 10 generals there, every one afraid to fight. If McClellan had 1,000,000 men, he would swear the enemy had 2,000,000, and then he would sit down and yell for 3. McClellan did have 3 traits that made him too popular to replace easily. First, he fed his army well and displayed it on parade whenever possible. He was viewed as cautious with the lives of his soldiers, and he displayed great energy and confidence by dashing around on his horse in view of the troops. McClellan obtained good rations and established new examination boards that produced better quality officers, raising his reputation among the line soldiers. Second, he paid the army regularly. And lastly, through his reluctance to engage the enemy, the army suffered few casualties. These traits earned him the admiration of his soldiers and the affection of the public that would only dissipate after his first major loss at Antietam when he failed to roll up Lee's army. But they also evoked unceasing frustration from the president. Lincoln bore a considerable degree of responsibility, however, for making McClellan into a monster. The president's unaffected manner of speaking, his penchant for storytelling to make a point, and above all, his lack of social refinement led McClellan to misjudge him. The general wrote that Lincoln was not a man of very strong character, certainly in no sense a gentleman. Lincoln's deference finally reached its end. Unhappy with McClellan's dithering, in January 1862, Lincoln issued the President's General War Order No. 1, instructing McClellan to move forward by February. As he had throughout most of the previous few months, McClellan outnumbered his rebel opponents by about 3-to-1. Yet he still advanced cautiously in what had been labeled the Virginia Peninsula Campaign of 1862. Rather than approach Richmond directly, McClellan advanced obliquely with an army of 112,000 along the peninsula between the York and James Rivers, where the Union Navy could provide cover. As McClellan neared Richmond, things fell apart. First, Lincoln unwisely reduced McClellan's command by withholding Irwin McDowell's entire corps in a reorganization of the army, placing McDowell south of Washington to protect the capital. Second, McClellan wasted valuable time, a month, capturing Yorktown. Begging Lincoln for McDowell's men, who finally headed south toward Fredericksburg, McClellan reluctantly moved on Richmond. By that time, Lee had become the commander of the Army of Northern Virginia and McClellan's main foe. Lee's second-in-command, Stonewall Jackson, set the table for Union failure through a series of bold raids on Yankee positions all over the Shenandoah Valley. Jackson's high theater struck terror in the hearts of Washingtonians who were convinced he was going to invade at any moment, despite the fact that Jackson had only 16,000 men facing more than 45,000 Union troops. He succeeded in distracting McClellan long enough that the opportunity to drive into Richmond vanished. Instead, the Union and Confederate armies fought a series of moving battles throughout June and July of 1862, including the battles of Seven Pines, Mechanicsville, Gaines Mill, Frazier's Farm, and others. At Malvern Hill, McClellan finally emerged with a victory, though he still had not taken Richmond. The battle could have served as a profound lesson for both Lee at Gettysburg and Grant at Cold Harbor when it came to hurling troops across open ground against artillery, and indeed was the only battle of the war on the Confederate side where more casualties were caused by cannon than by musket fire. With a touch of painful irony, Confederate casualties at Malvern Hill numbered 5,600, strikingly similar to the losses in Pickett's Charge. Murmurings in Washington had it that he could have walked into the Confederate capital, but the last straw, for now at least, for Lincoln, came with a letter McClellan wrote on July 7th in which the general strayed far from military issues and dispensed political advice well above his pay grade. At that point, a rising group of Republicans known as the Radicals emerged. Some of the Radicals had been abolitionists before the war, and they tended to view the conflict as not only about emancipation, but also about cleansing from the body politic the disloyal and treasonous plantation elites of the Democratic Party they saw as having brought on the war. Among the most prominent Radicals were Charles Sumner of Massachusetts, Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, Joshua Giddings of Ohio, and Union General Carl Schurz, all of whom wanted to severely punish the South as a region and the Democrats as a party for bringing on the war. When the Radicals heard of McClellan's insubordination, not to mention, in their eyes, incompetence, they pressured Lincoln to remove him, and he acceded to their demands, replacing America's Bonaparte with General John Pope. Demoted as Supreme Commander, McClellan remained in charge of the Army of the Potomac. John Pope was a braggart who told Congress that if he had been in charge from the beginning, his forces would already be marching through New Orleans. Pope was soon humiliated more than McClellan. Despite victories over Pope, Lee had lost proportionately more staggering numbers of men. At the 7 days' battles, Mechanicsville, Malvern Hill, for example, the South lost 5,700 men, 13% of the force committed, and at Second Manassas it lost more than 9,000 men, more than 18% of the troops engaged. For the time being, however, Union congressmen's anger at the outcome concealed from them the raw arithmetic of combat. Water War. While conflict on land raged in the east, good news for the Union came from the war at sea. In September 1861, Navy flotillas had captured the forts at Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, establishing a tiny beachhead in the south. 2 months later, the U.S. Navy seized the South Carolina Sea Islands and Port Royal. The relatively easy conquest reflected both the North's superiority at sea and, at the same time, the magnitude of the task that still remained. Jefferson Davis admitted as much. At the inception of hostilities, he pointed out, we had no commercial marine, while their merchant vessels covered the ocean. We were without a navy, while they had powerful fleets. Nevertheless, the Union had to cover more than 3,000 miles if one measured in a straight line rather than calculated the space of every inlet and bay. Policing the entire coastline was impossible, but grabbing key ports was not. The blockade also posed the danger that an aggressive Union captain would fire on a foreign ship or board a neutral vessel. At all costs, Lincoln needed to keep Britain and France out of the conflict. In May, Britain announced strict neutrality, allowing for the Confederates to fight for their independence, but also acknowledging the legality of the Union blockade. Thus, the British could simultaneously recognize the Confederate and Union war aims as legitimate. Reality dictated that John Bull might, therefore, fall on the Union side, since British ships would not cross the blockade line. In November 1861, however, when Jefferson Davis dispatched John Slidell and James Mason as permanent envoys to Britain and France aboard a British ship, the Trent, U.S. Navy Captain Charles Wilkes aboard the USS San Jacinto stopped the Trent by firing shots across her bow. Boarding the vessel, Union sailors removed Mason and Slidell and transported them to New York City, from where they were declared prisoners of war and remanded to Fort Warren in Boston. British outrage not only produced a stern letter from the foreign minister, but was also followed by deployment of 11,000 redcoats to Canada and vessels to the Western Atlantic. Wilkes's unauthorized and unwise act threatened to do what the rebels themselves had been unable to accomplish, namely to bring in Britain as a Confederate ally. Seward perhaps relished the developments, having failed to provoke his multinational war of unification, but Lincoln was not amused. Scarcely a month after they were abducted, the two diplomats were released on Christmas Day, 1861. Britain considered this an acceptable apology, and the matter ended. All that remained of the naval war was a last-gasp Confederate attempt to leapfrog the North with technology. Had the roles been reversed, the North, with its industrial and technical superiority under pressure, might have successfully found a solution to the blockade. But for the already deficient Confederacy, despite its superlative naval secretary, Stephen R. Mallory, the gap between the two combatants became obvious when the rebels launched their blockade breaker, the CSS Virginia. Better known as the Merrimack, the vessel was the Union steam frigate the Confederacy had confiscated when it took the Norfolk Navy Yard. Outfitted with 4 inches of iron siding, the ship was impressive compared to wooden vessels, yet hardly a technological marvel. Britain had launched an ironclad, Warrior, in 1859. The Virginia's 10 guns fired from holes cut in the iron siding, which could be closed off by hand. A single gun covered the bow and stern. Most of the superstructure was above water, including the smokestack, lifeboat, and the entire gun deck. In March 1862, the Virginia sortied out under the command of Captain Franklin Buchanan to engage Union blockading vessels at Hampton Roads. The astonished Yankee sailors watched as their cannonballs bounced harmlessly off the sides of the monster, which quickly sank the Cumberland and then the Congress, two of the Navy's best frigates. The Union itself had already had contracts for several variants of its own ironclads, known by the name of the lead vessel, the Monitor, whose design was the brainchild of a brilliant Swedish designer, John Ericsson. It surpassed the Virginia in almost every category. At 172 feet long, its hull barely sat above the waterline, leading to its description as a cracker box on a raft. It boasted a revolving turret capable of withstanding 10-inch shot at close range and brandished its own 2 11-inch Dahlgren smoothbore cannons. It also had some 50 of Ericsson's inventions aboard, including the first flushing toilets on a naval vessel. Upon the Monitor's arrival at Hampton Roads, it was charged with protecting the larger Minnesota. On March 9, 1862, the Virginia sallied forth, and Ericsson's Pygmy engaged it. Blasting away at each other for hours, neither could gain an advantage, but the Monitor could position herself where the Virginia could not bring a single gun to bear. Still, neither could seriously damage the other, and the two ships withdrew, each for a different reason. The Monitor's captain had been blinded by a shell, and the Virginia's second-in-command, having replaced the wounded Buchanan, realized he could not outmaneuver or outshoot the Monitor with his current vessel. The Virginia's draft was so deep that it continually ran aground, and efforts to lighten the ship so that it could better maneuver only exposed its hull. Subsequently, the Virginia was run ashore and burned when its commander feared that other ships like the Monitor were about to capture her. Later, in December 1862, the USS Monitor sank in a gale off Cape Hatteras, but many of her sisters joined the Federal Navy in inland waterways and along the coasts. Confederate Navy Secretary Mallory, meanwhile, had funded other ironclads, and 37 had been completed or were under construction by the war's end. He also approved an experiment using a mine ram in an underwater vessel called the CSS Hunley, an unfortunate vessel that suffered several fatalities during its sea trials. Although not the world's first submarine, the hand-cranked boat was the first to actually sink an enemy ship, the Housatonic, and itself in February 1864. Yet these efforts smacked of desperation. The Confederacy had neither the resources nor a sufficient critical mass of scientific and technical brain power or institutions to attempt to leapfrog the North in technology. War in the West. While coastal combat determined the future of the blockade and control of the eastern port cities, and while the ground campaign in Virginia dragged on through a combination of McClellan's obsessive caution and Confederate defensive strategy, action shifted to the Mississippi River region. Offensives in the west, where Confederates controlled Forts Donelson and Henry on the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers, held the key to securing avenues into Tennessee and northern Alabama. Implementing the Anaconda Plan down the Mississippi, then, depended on wresting those important outposts from the rebels. General Ulysses Simpson Grant, an engineer from West Point who had fought in the Mexican War, emerged as the central figure in the West. This was surprising given that only a year earlier he had failed in a series of professions, struggled with alcohol, and wallowed in debt. Grant took his Mexican War experience, where he compiled a solid understanding of logistics as well as strategy, and applied his moral outrage over slavery to it. His father-in-law owned slaves, and James Longstreet, Lee's second in command at Gettysburg, was his wife's cousin and an army buddy. But Grant's own father had abolitionist tendencies, and he himself soon came to view slavery as a clear evil. When the Civil War came, Grant saw it not only as an opportunity for personal resurrection, but also as the chastisement he thought the slave South had earned. He was commissioned a colonel in the Illinois Volunteers and worked his way up to brigadier general in short order. Grant did not take long to make his mark on the Confederates. Swinging down from Cairo, Illinois in a great semicircle, he captured Paducah, Kentucky. Then, supported by a river flotilla of gunboats, he moved on the two Confederate rivermouth forts that guarded the entrance to the western part of the Confederacy. On February 6, 1862, Grant's joint land and river force took Fort Henry on the Tennessee River, and Fort Donelson, the guardian of the Cumberland River, fell a few days later. When the fort's commander asked for terms, Grant responded grimly, "Unconditional and immediate surrender." Given the Army's penchant for nicknames, it was perhaps unavoidable that he soon became known as Unconditional Surrender Grant. Donelson's capitulation genuinely reflected Grant's approach to war. "Find out where your enemy is," he said, "then get at him as soon as you can and strike him as hard as you can and keep moving on." Grant's success laid open both Nashville and Memphis. Northern journalists, inordinately demoralized by Bull Run, swung unrealistically in the opposite direction after Grant's successes. The Chicago Tribune declared, "Chicago reeled mad with joy," and the New York Times predicted that, "the monster is already clutched and in his death struggle." Little did they know that the South was about to launch a major counterattack at a small church named Shiloh near Pittsburgh Landing on the Tennessee River. Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston knew by then, if he had not before, the difficulty of the task confronting him. He clung to a perimeter line almost 300 miles long, largely bordered by rivers, fighting an opponent who commanded the waterways while he lacked sufficient railroads to counter the rapid concentration of forces by the Union at vulnerable points along the rivers. Now the South's reliance on river transportation as opposed to railways had come back to haunt the war effort. Rather than dig in, Johnston typically attacked. Grant's troops were spread out while the general was planning the next part of his offensive. He had no defensive works, nor did he have any real lines of communication or supply. His headquarters was 9 miles away on the other side of the Tennessee River. Although the troops at Shiloh and Pittsburgh Landing were the most raw of recruits, they had the good fortune of being commanded by the able William Tecumseh Sherman. Early on the morning of April 6, 1862, Confederate forces quietly marched through the fog nearly into the Yankee camp until warnings sounded and musket fire erupted. For the next 6 hours, the armies slammed into each other at hurricane force with shocking casualties. In the peach orchard, both sides were blinded by a blossom snowstorm created by the din of rifle and cannon shot. By all accounts, the midday hours at Shiloh were the bloodiest of the war, with more Union and rebel bodies falling per minute than in any other clash. Albert Sidney Johnston himself became a casualty, hit below and behind the knee by a musket ball. Aides could not locate the wound, which was hidden by his high riding boots, and the unconscious Johnston died in their arms. Fighting at Shiloh ended on the first day with a Confederate advantage, but not a decisive victory. The Yanks found themselves literally backed up to the banks of the Tennessee River. General Lew Wallace, later famous for writing Ben Hur, finally arrived after confusing orders that had him futilely marching across the Tennessee countryside. General Don Carlos Buell arrived after steaming up the Tennessee River with 25,000 men. Grant himself had come up from the rear ranks, and on the second day, with the reinforcements in place, the counterattack drove the rebels from the field and forced Johnston's successor, P.G.T. Beauregard, to withdraw south to Corinth, Mississippi. It was a joyless victory given the carnage. Grant recalled that he could walk across the clearing in any direction, stepping on dead bodies without a foot touching the ground. Tennessee was opened in 1862. Meanwhile, Beauregard could not hope to hold Corinth against the combined forces of Pope, Grant, and Buell, and therefore conducted a secret withdrawal that opened up northern Mississippi. Just 2 months earlier, in April 1862, Commander David Farragut captured New Orleans, and Memphis, too, had fallen. Now only Vicksburg stood between the Union and complete control of the Mississippi. Vicksburg not only dominated the river, but it also linked the South to the Western Confederacy by rail. There, the blockade had been more porous, allowing food and horses to resupply rebel armies in the East. The story in the West seemed grimly monotonous. The Confederates would mount an offensive, despite their supposedly defensive strategy, suffer proportionately greater losses, retreat, then escape as the Union commander dawdled. Union General William Rosecrans attacked Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in December 1862. Again, the Confederates had to leave the field despite achieving a draw. Slowly but surely, the Confederates, who took one step forward and two back, yielded ground. For the remainder of 1862 and the first half of 1863, the Union failed to capture Vicksburg, which sat on a high bluff commanding a hairpin curve in the Mississippi River. Vicksburg's geography held the key to the city's nearly invulnerable position. The city sat on the eastern Mississippi side of the hairpin, while directly north of the hairpin lay the Chickasaw Bayou. This swamp was all but impenetrable for an army, as Sherman found out, calling the approach hopeless. A main road and rail line connected Vicksburg with Jackson, Mississippi. Grant's army tried a number of novel approaches to defeat this geography, including diverting the river itself by constructing a canal and breaking a levee to create a channel from the Yazoo River. Nothing worked. Using Memphis as a base, however, Grant now decided to take Vicksburg by siege. Grant discarded traditional tactics and moved southward along the Louisiana side of the river through difficult bayous and lakes to a point well below Vicksburg where he could recross into Mississippi. To do so, he needed the Union Navy under Admiral David Porter to make a critical run from above Vicksburg past the powerful guns in the city to the junction below, from where it could ferry Grant's forces across. Porter sent dozens of supply boats past the city on the night of April 22, 1863. The Confederates had poured turpentine over bales of hay and set them afire to illuminate the river in order to bombard the passing vessels. Although most Federal ships sustained damage, all but one survived the run. Grant's army now crossed into Mississippi from below Vicksburg, inserting itself between John Pemberton's forces in Vicksburg and Joe Johnston's army at Jackson. Grant rapidly marched against the latter before Pemberton could discern his intentions, chasing Johnston out of the Mississippi capital quickly enough to turn on Pemberton and defeat him at Champion Hill as he came to aid Johnston's army. Vicksburg was totally isolated. Then, from late May until July, the Union Army bombarded and closed the noose around the city from the east. Civilians living in Vicksburg, under constant fire, had run out of normal food. When Grant sealed off the city, the residents took to caves and bomb-proof shelters. They ate soup boiled from mule and horse ears and tails before finally consuming the remaining parts of the beasts. When the horses and mules were gone, they ate rats. Sickness and disease swept the inhabitants as well as the soldiers. At last, on the 4th of July, 1863, Pemberton, unable to link up with Johnston outside the city, surrendered Vicksburg and its force of 30,000 starving soldiers, as well as 170 cannons, just one day after the crushing defeat of Lee's army at Gettysburg. Grant said, "The fate of the Confederacy was sealed when Vicksburg fell." Lincoln had at last found what he needed to defeat the Confederacy. With eerie prescience, Lincoln told his advisors just before news arrived from Vicksburg that if the general took the city, "Grant is my man and I am his for the rest of the war." Growing governments. No accusation against Abraham Lincoln has more merit than that he presided over the most rapid expansion of federal power in American history. Most of the expansion can be justified by wartime demands, but too much was little more than political pork barreling and fulfillment of campaign promises. Shortly after the call had gone out for troops, the government possessed no proven method of raising large sums of money quickly. Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury, Salmon P. Chase, proved to be the right man in the right office at the right time. Chase came from a New Hampshire family, where he learned politics from his state representative father. As a young man, Chase had also worked with his father at running a tavern and a glass factory, and when both failed, he was shipped off to an Ohio relative. After studying for the bar in Ohio, Chase practiced on behalf of the Cincinnati branch of the Bank of the United States, achieving some degree of financial success. Aloof, plodding, and occasionally without tact, Chase had been drawn to the anti-slavery cause following rioting in Cincinnati against a local abolitionist paper run by James G. Birney. Politically, Chase moved from the Whig Party to the Liberty Party, then adopted the label Free Democrat. He had won a Senate seat as a Democrat from Ohio, but continued to push the Free Soil cause before running for governor in Ohio under a fusion Republican ticket in 1855. Winning the governor's seat, Chase and the legislature attempted to expand the state's free banking laws, providing a harbinger of his financial expertise as Treasury Secretary. Like Seward, he was disappointed to lose the Republican presidential nomination in 1860, and even though he was offered another U.S. Senate seat by the Ohio legislature, he never took it. Instead, he reluctantly accepted Lincoln's offer of the Treasury post. Chase confronted a daunting task. In 1850, the federal government's budget averaged 2% of gross national product, GNP, but by the end of the Civil War, it had soared to more than 15%. Merely running the Treasury in such circumstances constituted a challenge. The number of clerks in the department increased from 383 in 1861 to more than 2,000 in 1864. To fill the necessary positions, Chase unwisely appointed many party hacks who often could be relied upon for little else but their partisan loyalty. Raising the necessary funds to run the war demanded that Chase not only develop systems for generating lots of revenue, but also for bringing it into the Treasury fairly quickly. At the same time, he did not want to sacrifice long-term stability for short-term gains. Copying Alexander Hamilton, Chase examined a menu of options to serve both short- and long-term needs. Taxes, for example, had to be passed by Congress, then collected, meaning that it would be 1862 or later before tax revenues provided much help to the cause. So while Chase immediately asked Congress for a new direct tax on incomes over $300, he simultaneously requested new tariffs and expanded land sales that would generate quicker revenues. Even when the taxes came in at the end of 1863, the $2 million they produced was inadequate to the Union's needs, which by the end of 1861 ran $2 million per day. Meanwhile, in addition to other shorter-term bond issues, Congress authorized Chase to raise $250 million through sales of 20-year bonds paying 7% interest. Banks hesitated to buy bonds if they had to pay for them in gold, and in December 1861, the Northern banks suspended specie payments on all notes. The Confederacy's banks had gone off the gold standard almost immediately after Fort Sumter. Concerned that soldiers would go unpaid, Chase advanced a paper money concept to Congress that would allow the Treasury to issue $100 million in notes that would circulate as lawful money and a legal tender of all debts, public and private. Enacted as the Legal Tender Act of February 1862, the proposal authorized the issue of more than Chase requested, 450 million of the new green-colored bills, called greenbacks, which, like the national bank notes that soon followed, the government accepted for payment of taxes, giving them at least some value at all times. The temporary money gave the nation a wartime circulating medium and also enabled the government to pay its bills. Congress also authorized Chase to borrow an additional $500 million. Nevertheless, the 520 bonds, redeemable after 5 years, maturing to full value after 25, and paying 6% interest, did not sell as fast as Chase hoped. He relied on a personal friend, Philadelphia banker Jay Cook, to sell the bonds through a special, though not exclusive, contract. Cook received a nice commission, but more important, he held a virtual monopoly on the bond sales. In the hands of other men, that might have been a problem, but not with the motivated Cook, who placed ads in newspapers and aggressively targeted the middle class as well as traditional silk-tie investors. Conceiving the first true war bond, Cook appealed to Northerners' patriotism and oversubscribed every issue. He sold $400 million worth by the end of 1863 alone, netting himself $1 million in commissions and making him the Civil War equivalent of Robert Morris. Chase came up with yet another menu option to accelerate the revenue stream. Using as a model the free banking laws popular in the North prior to the war, wherein banks would purchase bonds that they would keep on deposit with the Secretary of State as security against overissue of notes, In his December 1861 report to Congress, Chase argued for a national banking system in which the banks would receive their charters after purchasing government bonds. Congress passed the National Banking Act of February 1863, which provided for $300 million in national banknotes to be issued by the new network of national banks, who would, in turn, themselves purchase bonds as their entry permit into the business. Nevertheless, the law offered no incentive for people to hold national banknotes over private banknotes. By December 1863, fewer than 150 national banks operated, and only in 1864 did Congress fix the loophole by placing a 10% tax on money issued by state banks. Of all the Civil War legislation, aside obviously from emancipation, this act had the most far-reaching consequences, most of them bad. Although Congress increased the number of national banks in operation, 1,650 by December 1865, the destruction of the competitive money private note issue system led to a string of financial upheavals occurring like clockwork every 20 years until 1913. Competition in money had not only given the United States the most rapidly growing economy in the world, but it had also produced numerous innovations at the state level, the most important of which, branch banking, was prohibited by national banks. Thus, not only did the National Bank and Currency Acts establish a government monopoly over money, but they also excluded the most efficient and stable form of banking yet to emerge, although that mistake would be partially corrected in the 1920s. Critics of Lincoln's big government policies are on firm ground when they assail the banking policy of the Civil War. In contrast, however, the North's financial strategy far surpassed that of the Confederacy under its Treasury Secretary Christopher G. Memminger, a South Carolina lawyer. Memminger, like Chase, at one time was a hard money man, and like Chase, he also acceded to wartime requirements of quick revenues. He embraced taxation, borrowing, and fiat money. Although the Confederate Constitution forbade tariffs, the CSA's Congress almost immediately imposed a range of duties, and with no Supreme Court to overrule it, the acts stuck. And in sharp contrast to the U.S. Constitution's prohibition against export tariffs, the CSA also imposed export taxes. By 1863, the Confederacy had adopted a wide range of taxes, including direct income taxes and taxes on gold. Possessing a smaller and less industrial economy on which to draw, the South found it more difficult to borrow money through bond issues, raising one-third of its wartime revenue needs through borrowing, compared to two-thirds in the North. Worse, when the Confederate Congress authorized a second $100 million loan in August 1861, planters were allowed to pay for it in cotton, not gold. The Confederacy, thanks to its short-sighted embargo, was already drowning